It takes about the same effort. You're going to do the same title policy. You're going to have open the same escrow. You're going to do a closing. You're going to purchase it. You're going to sell it. All those steps, the same effort and energy is being expanded. Those people that are saying, oh, I take 500 and turn it into 2,500. Well, what if you took 5,000, but you turn it into 25,000 or you take 25,000? You know what I mean? Like the same effort is going into it.
Welcome to Turning Profit, a podcast for people that love real estate. Learn the business models and skills that professional real estate investors use to make money and build wealth. Visit turningprofit.com for a wealth of investor resources. And now, here are your hosts, Pete and Heather Reese.
Welcome to the Turning Profit podcast. Heather, it's so great to be here once again.
I know, right?
You've taken a little hiatus from the show, but you're back. And the real talent is with us on the show now again.
That's unfortunate for our daughter.
Oh, no, I don't mean it that way. I just meant it like you're the focus of attention of this whole thing. I'm just a accessory feature.
Okay, well, that's not true.
Okay.
But I do appreciate that. That was nice of you. And I appreciate Maddie filling in for me. That was
she did a great job. And we also had some other podcasts with guests.
We did. We had a bunch of guests.
Some guests, yes.
Yeah, and we even did some of our, like, reran some of the top
greatest
ones.
Hits.
Thank you. That's greatest what I was hits. Looking for. So but, what are we... Go ahead. You're going to say it, right?
Well, I'll just say, yeah, I'll just get into it. You know, like, what are we talking about today? And the focus is, for us, is doing bigger and bigger deals. I figured we'd put together an episode of 9 ways to do big land deals and how to think bigger overall. I know that's a topic that I'm just super, super focused on, because the bigger deals just lead to more progress. And anytime we get caught up in doing the smaller deals, I regret it.
Why?
Well, because the smaller deals... It's a crazy thing, but the smaller the deal, the more time they take and the more hassle they are. And, you know, there's exception to every rule. But kind of the thing is that the smaller deals seem to be more problems. So it's kind of the opposite of more money, more problems. It's kind of like the smaller money, more problems.
Right. And we've noticed that for years and years doing real estate. The lower the cost of the property, it's normally the bigger the challenge to get it closed. Every single step of it seems to be...
Right.
More difficult. No. And like you said, that's not 100%. There's been plenty of big deals that are very big pain in the butts. But I think it's that 80-20 kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
And I think that a lot of people too, if you're doing your own real estate business, probably know it's a lot. If you have to put in the same effort, I'd rather make 5 times the cost or 5 times the profit, I should say.
Yes.
You know, if you think of it that way, you're still going to be doing the exact same steps. So use 9 ways to do big land deals.
Yes.
Okay. And how to think bigger. Is the working title. I like that, because I think that's also a mindset thing. It seems a lot safer. You see people when they get started with real estate, or land specifically, they'll be like, I want to buy desert squares. And you really ask them, like, well, why do you want to buy desert? And it's because they feel like the risk isn't there. It's less price. It's, you know, it's a brain thing more than a structural thing.
Yeah, I see this a lot. They're like, well, I can quintuple my money. I can buy a property for $500 and I can sell it for $2,500. Mm-hmm. You know, and that sounds great. Like, that sounds amazing. But there's no way to, like, really scale up that type of business to any sort of meaningful numbers. I mean, I guess meaningful is different to each person, but that's really tough to scale into a real business where you're, you know, you're buying $500 parcels and you're really trying to make some extraordinary profit.
I mean, it's a real business, but you mean, like, where you can support having employees and the infrastructure to run a real business is what you mean.
That's
by
a great
that.
Way to put it, Heather.
So it's not necessarily like you're not running a real business. It's that a business that's not just you, which also then can lead to burnout. If you're doing everything, it sounds like romantic and wonderful until you have to do every single thing. You get sick and you're like, well, I don't know what to do. You know,
everything shuts down. You wear all the hats.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, and I just keep going back to the thing that it takes about the same effort. You're going to do the same title policy. You're going to have open the same escrow. You're going to do a closing. You're going to purchase it. You're going to sell it. All those steps, the same effort and energy is being expanded. So if you could make those people that are saying, oh, I take 500 and turn it into 2,500. Well, what if you took 5,000? We're going to talk way bigger than that, but you turn it into 25,000 or you take 25,000. You know what I mean? Like, the same effort is going into it. So, okay, well, let's get started with, are we still doing the same thing? Like, do we have questions at the end still?
Yeah. We still have the same format, Heather. We have questions at the end from our community, which is the Land Conquest community. You can find us by going to landconquest.com, or we're also on the school platform directly. So if you go to school, which is spelled SKOOL.com/landconquest, you'll find us. And we are one of the largest free real estate investing communities on the whole platform. Yeah. And there's a lot of groups on that platform now.
You just have to give us all your personal information. And no, I'm just kidding. It's not. No, it's personal literally, information. Literally yeah. a free community. Okay. Well, so you put down number one. Are these in order?
Sure. Well, they're in order of the way I put them on the paper.
Okay. So you're not going to, it's not going to throw off.
They're not in preference, in order of preference of like what I like or anything like that. So.
Okay. So you put down here minor subdivisions.
Yes.
So this is one way to do big land deals. And then tell me the mindset behind a minor subdivision.
Minor subdivision would be simply, I guess the easiest way to explain it would be to give an example. Say we buy a 100-acre property. Mm-hmm. We split it up into five 20-acre properties, and then we sell those 20-acre properties individually. And the reason you do that is because generally you can buy a larger parcel for a lower price per acre. Mm-hmm. And then when you sell a smaller parcel, smaller child parcel off of that, you can achieve a higher price per acre.
Do you just call it a child?
Well, a child parcel. Okay, I don't know if that's a real term.
We're selling off our children.
Like, no, we're not selling off our kids. Okay. So I don't know that we'd be getting too much.
Do you think you made that up?
Yeah. No, I'm just joking.
Depending on the child. That's so bad.
Possible I may have made it up or I've heard it before.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
So you know, the concept is basically you are creating value. Mm-hmm. You are buying for a lower price per acre. You are splitting it up. And generally, on these minor subdivisions, splitting it up means that you're hiring a surveyor and in the areas that we like to deal in, at least, you're hiring a surveyor. The surveyor will actually do the split for you, and then they record it with the county. So we're not looking to do this in areas where it's a super difficult process. We are looking to do it in areas where it's very easy. We hire the surveyor, they do their job, and then we simply sell off the smaller parcels.
And I think that's another way that talking about how we like to go to places where the rules are already set up.
And not just rules already set up, but where we know that the rules are set up and they're easy.
Right, right.
Because I wouldn't attempt that in San Diego County here in California. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very, very difficult process, years long process. In some of these areas that we deal with, I mean, it can take, you know, few weeks. Okay. I mean, simply the matter of time for the surveyor to do their work and then record it with the county. It's a very easy process. So
it's not just about the rules being set up. It's that the rules are set up and the process is streamlined.
Right.
It's quick. You're not holding it for 5 years.
Right.
Just to hopefully, fingers crossed, get the okay.
Now, the interesting thing about this is lots of nuance to any sort of business model, but each area has different rules. Mm-hmm. So you need to really understand what those rules are. And are you able to comply with that? And then the other thing is, in some areas, there's a larger discrepancy between the, if you're buying a larger property and the price per acre you can buy it for, and then what you could sell it for as the smaller property. Mm-hmm. So sometimes there's a big spread, you know, just kind of naturally in that area, by the way the market is. And then some areas, there's not much of a difference at all. So there isn't as much opportunity in those areas where, you know, if you sell off a smaller parcel, you might get a little bit of a bump on the price per acre, but
Not enough to make it work.
Yeah.
What about, do you look for areas that have engineers that are available? Like, does that ever come into play where it's like, okay, this could be decent, but you can't find anyone to do it for months and months?
Yeah, that's a problem sometimes. And so you have to kind of take that case by case basis. So generally we find a property like this, and part of our due diligence process is that we are calling around for surveyors to get bids and timing. And if we're having a problem finding a surveyor or the bids are way too high, something like that, then, you know, that's part of our due diligence. We may not proceed with the actual purchase. That's a really easy way to get into some of these bigger projects. Mm-hmm. So minor subdivisions, I know, might sound daunting if you've never done something like that, but it's really not that complicated in some areas. You just want to kind of leverage the experts in that particular area. And a lot of times that is, you know, the hiring the surveyor and letting them do their job.
Was there anything else you wanted to add to that before I move on?
No, I think that's pretty much it. That's a tactic that we use quite frequently in our land business. So we love minor subdivisions. We're always looking for more of those, and we will continue to do them. So, one other thing I guess I should mention is sometimes as part of those minor subdivisions, we'll also do some improvements to the properties as well, other value add, as we call that. And that could be things like getting a septic approved, septic system approved for each lot. It could be flagging, you know, the property lines. That's generally what we do. And then also brush clearing. You know, if there's a lot of brush on the property, you can't walk around. So we'll clear like some paths and maybe a potential home site. And that really seems to add some value. You can also do things like, you know, putting in driveways and fencing and all these types of things. We generally don't get into those, but I know other land investors do some of those things depending on the area.
Right. I'm sure that you know, based off the community character, if all of them have, you know, like that in their higher end, that would make sense maybe.
Yep. And it's an equation always for us. Like, is this investing money into this driveway, for instance, is this going to increase the value of the property? And is it going to allow us to sell it quicker? So mm-hmm. those are two things that we really look at. So we just look at it on a case-by-case basis, and each area is a little bit different, and we try to make the best call that we can.
You know, one thing we didn't cover is, well, why is it a lot of times that you can sell a smaller parcel, you know, like 5 acres, as opposed to, let's say you bought a 25-acre parcel. Mm-hmm. Why can you get better pricing for... you're on the resale market, 5 acres than 25 acres.
Generally, it's because there's a much larger buyer pool for the smaller properties than the larger properties. There are buyers for the larger properties, mm-hmm. people looking for those types of things. But generally, you're looking for something that kind of conforms to a standard home site for that particular area, or maybe a standard range of home site. So if you're outside of that, you're just basically decreasing your buyer pool because... it's more land than a lot of people need.
Right. So, and affordability too.
Yes, and affordability. That's a big part of it.
You know, they would probably be able to afford a 5 acres versus 25 acres.
Right.
Or exactly. Yeah, just for me, I'm like, I don't know if I want 25 acres. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's a lot to take care of, or any number of reasons. Okay. Let's move on to major subdivisions.
Yeah. So major subdivisions is kind of another variant of like splitting up these larger parcels into smaller parcels. But this is really taking things much further. Want to learn the secret to building a thriving land flipping business? Head on over to landconquest.com and join over 2,000 passionate land flippers leveraging the power of community to scale quickly. Sign up for free at landconquest.com. All right, let's get back to the show. This is generally when you consider like a residential subdivision, maybe a tract home subdivision or something like that. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about taking a raw piece of land, talking about going through a major subdivision process, and that's kind of how these counties and municipalities label these things. They have a minor subdivision, which is the easy process generally, and then the major subdivision, which is kind of the major process. And these take much longer generally. I mean, I think on the low end, you're probably 6 to 9 months. Higher end, depending on the areas, you could be 3 years to get a fully entitled major subdivision. So as a land investor, you're kind of getting into the developer world here, at least the early stage development world. So you are taking a raw piece of land. It's got to be zoned properly for these major subdivisions generally, or you'll have to get the zoning changed. You're working with an engineer generally, and you're working with, getting environmental reports. You're basically going through a whole checklist of different people that you're hiring to do different aspects of what the county or the municipality is going to want to see in order to get this project approved. You know, also along with this comes public hearings. You've got things like that to deal with. You have to have access to utilities generally. So there's lots of things to consider. It's definitely more advanced than the minor subdivisions in many ways, but the upside is potentially there. So a business model that many land investors use that are into this development space is they are getting these projects approved on paper. So they're doing what they call paper subdivision. They're going through the approval process. They're going through the county. They're paying all the engineers in order to get it to the stage where it's like a fully approved subdivision. And then what they do is they flip it to a home builder or another developer that actually takes it to the stage of building out the roads, building out the sidewalks, stubbing in utilities for each of these lots, grading, doing all those things. And then they might sell it. And then be another stage where they sell it to the actual builder that will build out the homes. It can be very lucrative. It's just a longer time horizon for these things. And you know, there's more risk. You know, you're putting in more money into these projects, and there's no guarantee that it's actually going to pay off.
But when it does, it does.
Yes. So
it's like one of those things where you might want to do multiple things. So you have one of these going, you have all these different things going. I think a lot of people get confused. Like, they'll have communities in or developments like this, and they'll say, oh gosh, it changed hands again, thinking that there was something wrong.
Right.
And no, it's just that each step of the way somebody takes it, like, you know.
It's like a relay. They take a baton, they keep passing it off, you know, and there's different developers that focus on different stages of things. There's the early stage developers, kind of mid-stage developers, and maybe the final builder, you know, so it really just kind of depends.
And then you touched on this a little bit, but you said zoning changes. This is another area though that could be lucrative.
Yeah, this is another category. Yeah, and zoning changes are one of those things that if you find the right property, it could be a very lucrative thing. So say you find a piece of property that's a large agricultural property. And right next door to it is some large industrial property, warehouses, something like that. And it makes sense if you're looking at the map that, hey, this really should be industrial property. There's plenty of demand around this area, lots of building, lots of things happening and everything. And you realize that if you could get the zoning changed on this property to, say, industrial, that you're going to create a lot of value and basically make a lot of money on this investment. So that's a business model that that some land investors take as well. Again, it's simply, these zoning changes typically are not easy, meaning that each area is a little bit different on their process for a zoning change. And you have to hire engineers, you have to get them a proposal of what you think might be going on this property. You have to do the public hearing stuff. And, you know, there's a whole checklist of things that you have to go through. And then there's the risk that they're not going to approve it. So you invest all this money, they don't approve the zoning change, and you're kind of back to square one, except that you have more money invested in this property now than you did initially. And then you might not make as much.
We had one that kind of went that way. There's things to look out for. Small towns are maybe a little more difficult. It could be easier, but also could be more difficult if it comes down to a panel of people who just get to do whatever they want to do. And the types of zoning changes. So if you had something that's agriculture and you wanted to put a dentist office, that might be more difficult than change. You know what I mean? Than changing.
Yeah. I think a lot of times it just has to make sense to the municipality or the county or whoever you're dealing with. Like it has to make, you know, they've set these zoning maps up, you know, generally, you know, a long time ago.
Right.
And things kind of progress in a certain way. And then when you look at the map and you say, really, this is a commercial area. Things are happening here. Like this really should be commercial property. The municipalities many times are happy to change things to a
zoning
that makes them more money, brings them in more revenue. Uh-huh. So some of these businesses, some of these large industrial things are very appealing to them. But yes, you do have, you have the NIMBY thing, which stands for not in my backyard. So you have neighbors and things that might protest what you're trying to do and show up at the public hearings. And sometimes they have very limited power or they might have some say in what goes on. But it's just one of those things that you have to go through as part of this process. But it can be very lucrative. So you could change from one zoning to another. I mean, there's industrial, there's commercial, residential. You know, you could have an agricultural property that you say, well, this is perfect for a housing development. So you could try to get it zoned for the right zoning for that.
Especially if it butts right up to another one and they need housing. I think that, well, I know that when the zoning was first set, because everything was zoned, I thought that was interesting. I learned that a while back, that every single thing at one point was zoned. Every single thing on this planet, not on this planet, in the US and on this planet. This was like years and years and years ago. Things have changed. So yeah, they're thinking, you know, in the early 1900s, something that made sense that, well, we're going to need more wheat or tobacco fields or something. There's a lot of opportunity there. You just have to know going into it, you're going to have to put in the work.
Yeah.
What's another one that would kind of go wrong with that?
They could go wrong with that?
That would be a good segue to the next category.
Oh, okay. Yes.
That could go wrong with it. Well, I mean, now that you said it, everything could go wrong with it.
Everything can go wrong. Yes. Yeah. You spend money and you don't get a return. That's the worst thing that can happen. And your time as well. So the next big category here for another way to do a big land deal would be renewable energy projects. So these could be solar, they could be wind, they could be battery, or any sort of combination of those together.
What zoning normally allows for that?
It's different in each area.
Okay. And that's the other thing too. I realized earlier that something, if I understand the zoning, like it's C1 or something here, C1 might be different there.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't mean, just because it's the same acronym, don't assume that it's the exact same meaning everywhere, right?
Right.
So you're saying in every different area, that zoning is different.
Yes.
So just because you can do it here on a whatever it doesn't mean that that same thing is going to say okay over there.
You can look it up on the websites for these municipalities.
And if they're online.
If they're online. Most of them are, but there are some ones that aren't. But yeah, so you want to look them up and see what's permitted. They'll have charts of what's permitted in particular areas. And sometimes, since solar farms and wind farms and things are some newer developments, sometimes they don't have those specifically listed. So you have to call them and figure out what the deal is. And if it's not zoned for the right thing, then you could potentially get the zoning change, kind of a two-step process, get the zoning change and get the project approved. But there are, you know, hurdles to get these projects mm-hmm. approved. First of all, the zoning is one of them. There's also the NIMBY thing as well.
It's your new favorite word.
I think it sounds cool, NIMBY. So it's funny to me. Anyhow, so you have to make sure that you are presenting it properly to the community and how it could be an asset for the community to have the abundance of renewable energy.
Right. And there's certain areas that are way more into this than others. Right. So there's some that are like, hey, we've decided we're going to be the, you know, renewable energy.
Yeah, we're
going to
be the leader. Yes. Yeah.
And then there's some that are like, that's causes aliens to land and eat pizzas.
Some of the areas that have been traditionally big on producing energy with oil and gas or coal or something like that, they might have resistance to this because they feel like it's taking their livelihood. Mm-hmm. So
I think there's misinformation.
Yes, that sometimes comes up. If you can get a project approved on paper, mm-hmm. it's kind of like the housing development thing, mm-hmm. the major subdivision thing. There's different steps in the process. You have to go over different hurdles, get different approvals from different agencies. But if you can get that approved, you've created a bunch of value there. So you could then take it to the next step and actually get this project built out, or you could flip it to another developer that takes that next stage, takes the baton and runs with it one more time. And then they may ultimately sell out to a renewable energy fund or some sort of partner that is actually going to hold the project long term.
But you don't mean sell out like in a negative way. You mean literally sell the project out to.
Oh, yeah. I mean in a good way. They sell the ownership of the property to another entity that will hold it long term. Mm-hmm. And they will basically make a spread on what it costs to generate the electricity and what they get paid back. It's like a return, like if you own an apartment building or something like that.
Right. Something I'm noticing in a lot of these is that you don't have to commit to doing the whole thing.
No.
You could just do steps. Get to where you're comfortable and then pass it on from there, right?
Yeah.
Cash out, make some money, and then rinse and repeat.
Yeah. And I noticed one thing with land investors is mm-hmm. that, this is kind of a common trend. You might start on one of these paths mm-hmm. and, you know, say for renewable energy projects, you know, there's early stage developers, there's mid stage developers, and there's kind of the end users. But some of these companies kind of develop over time. Like they might start with the early stage, you know, that's kind of a good place to start. And then they might decide, okay, I know what I'm doing here. I'm going to progress to the next stage. I'm going to do the early stage and I'm actually going to build out the project. Mm-hmm. Once they get some of those under their belt, they may decide like, hey, I'd actually like to hold some of these projects long term. So it's kind of an evolution of some of these development companies. But
You're building your confidence.
Right.
You're getting more, you know, confident in what you're able to accomplish. Your understanding is growing and you're kind of, and then you see the money that you're leaving on the table by, you know, passing it off to somebody else.
That's right.
That makes sense, right? With everything. So the next one I want to get to is build to rent communities. And what do you mean by that?
There's a trend now that they're building home divisions, mm-hmm. single family home divisions that are actually built to rent. So it could be, you know, it looks like you're any other single family home subdivision, mm-hmm. but instead of selling the homes, they're actually renting them out. That's mm-hmm. their long-term plan. An entity, you know, maybe a large fund or something like that is actually owns all the homes in the community mm-hmm. and they rent them out. It's their long-term business plan. There's a trend towards developing these communities towards that build to rent communities.
So everyone in the community would be a renter. It probably would have more amenities, kind of like apartment buildings, I would imagine.
I would imagine, yeah. They could tailor it to something like that. You know, maybe, you know, the community swimming pool and things like that, rather than everyone having a swimming pool in their own backyard.
Because no one would be able to because you're renting.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And I see how that would be great because if you find the right zoning already, you can get the land. It's needed.
Yep.
Especially around here, we need rentals. So
yeah, and potentially it could be positioned as affordable housing as well. Mm-hmm. So if it's done right, that's a really interesting niche, and there's a lot of interest in that as well. So it would be the steps would be very similar, I think, in a lot of ways to the major subdivisions, but you would position things a little bit different, get it set up you know, different than you would with a major subdivision. I would say in a build to rent type scenario, mm-hmm. you'd probably really want to be talking to the end buyers, mm-hmm. you know, to find out what they want, what they need, and design it in a way that, that they're going to want to actually buy the project and make it happen.
Right, so, where they can just jump right yeah. in and go. And,
right.
Yeah.
Boost your land flipping earnings with our new Land Conquest business system. It's designed for efficiency and effectiveness. This cutting-edge software tool is your key to success in the land flipping industry. Streamline and automate your operations to scale your business to new heights. With our system, you get a customizable website with 6 professional templates to choose from, up to 5 dedicated phone numbers, each with their own chosen area codes for creating a trustworthy local presence. And as a bonus, you'll get a $25 credit for SMS and email sends. You'll also get access to our tech team to build any automations or customizations that you want. And not to mention, we've got a great dedicated community to the Land Conquest business system to help us all thrive together. And with every step of the way, you get our 24/7 live chat support. But that's not all. You'll also gain access to our exclusive community to connect and grow with fellow land flippers. Seize the opportunity to transform your business. Visit software.landconquest.com to check out the Land Conquest business system and unlock the next stage of your land flipping success.
Because, yeah, they probably do have specific needs. Like we were talking about, they might need, there's probably a lot of different things. They might even have to have a new school built or something. You see a lot of those kind of random things. So it'd be good to get ahead of that from the start.
Yep.
So the next one you have on here is RV boat storage facilities. I don't know why I haven't thought of that before, but that is like, I mean, I've thought of it, but I haven't really like, you know, put in the time because that is so needed, especially with more and more people getting RVs and boats.
So this is an interesting one. This is something you can generally do, I guess, relatively with not a lot of
Infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So especially if you're going to have just like gravel, mm-hmm. something like that. So you could buy a piece of property, you could fence it, you could put some gravel down, maybe put some basics infrastructure there. But mostly you are just renting out monthly for people that own RVs mm-hmm. or own boats and just looking for a place to store it. They might not have space where they're living, you know, whether it's an apartment or even at their home, like they may not have space for an RV there.
Well, some places don't let you park them.
Yes,
or boats, you
HOAs,
know,
yes.
So even nice. Well, a lot of places wouldn't, you know?
Yep. So, you know, this could be particularly appealing, maybe mm-hmm. If you find a piece of property close to a lake or, mm-hmm. you know, or for RVs, if you find something close to kind of a bigger population center just outside of it, you know, I think you might find a lot of success with something like that. And you could probably run the numbers and do pretty well on that and have a nice income producing business without, you know, maybe a ton of improvements. And maybe you started out small, maybe you put some minor infrastructure and then as you grow, you can make it more and more legit. You know, it's probably got to be the right zoning and mm-hmm. it's, you know, you have to be at least have a feeling that you can have the demand there in that area.
Yeah. So. And I imagine that's something like if you get you'd probably need security, your cameras, that kind of stuff. Right. Right? And maybe an automatic gate. So they come in and go, so you don't have to have someone sitting there. But once you get that filled up, you could probably sell that. That would be something that someone would happily jump on, right?
That's right.
By somebody who does this for a living, that this is all they do, would be like, oh, I can, you know, add this to my repertoire.
But in something like that, you're actually creating a business. So,
right.
You know, you're actually going to be filling out lease agreements with people and you're going to be collecting payments. You're going to be doing all this stuff that goes along with running the business. You're going to have issues that come up and someone ran into someone else's RV and, you know, you get a mm-hmm. things like this can happen. So
I wonder though, if you did everything, you set it all up, you get the fencing, you, I don't know, camera, whatever you have to do. And then you sell that.
Yeah. I'm sure you could.
Before you even like, hey, ready to go business.
Yeah. You sell it to an operator that's used to something like that. Or someone wants to take on a project like that.
Or you keep the land and you just sell the business.
Yes.
And then you become a landlord. But
yeah,
so I guess it's just be creative, right?
Yep.
Okay. So you also have on here physical improvements to improve value. I like this a lot because it's obvious, but I think people forget. Like a lot of these things people forget that can really increase the value. It's kind of like, remember we're selling houses and it was like people would remodel the whole place and then they didn't get the value back, right? But there were specific things that they could do that, you know, that really did increase it.
Right.
You know, it's stupid. It was like, remember people would weird paint, like color painted walls. People would walk in, be like, I could never buy this place. You paint it cheap white and now suddenly it gets the value. So what are some things that people can do that increase the value.
Some of the most common things that we do to improve these properties in these rural areas that we deal in, brush clearing is one of those things that, hey, if the property is so overgrown that you can't even walk on the property, it's going to be very hard to sell. So brush clearing is one of those simple things that we hire a brush clearing company to come out, clear some paths, clear maybe a potential home site, and instantly it's got this whole different feel to the property, and someone can go to the property, they can walk on there, and they can envision their home there and want to buy it, actually. And if they can't even walk on the property, it's still saleable, but it's going to be an uphill battle. It's going to take longer. You're probably not going to get as much as you wanted to for it. So that's one of those things that's really a big game changer for us.
I want to jump in because there's different ways that people can see things. Like you, when we went, we actually looked at some of our properties and North Carolina, maybe. Okay. So they were completely wooded. You walked through it. And yes. I was like, I'm not walking in there. Like, I'm like, I'm sorry.
That's fun to me.
But. Right. But that was like, there's probably ticks. I don't know. I was imagining. I'm like, nope, I'm staying out here. And I can't envision. Like, I looked at it. And I was like, well, this is really pretty. These trees are pretty. I can't envision anything. Like, my brain doesn't envision things. Whereas you, it envisions, right? But, and also we don't clear cut.
Right.
So, right. Like, I just want to like.
Yeah, no, I mean, generally we like to keep the trees and things like that.
So. Right. So when we're talking about this, we're not talking about bringing in a company to clear everything out. We're saying like an actual trail. So someone can walk through and be like, wow, look at this. This is really gorgeous. I get a feel for where my house would be. And then doing the
potential home site.
Yeah, exactly. Like you get onto that and you're like, wow, I could live here. Look at this. I could have this. And it's, you know, it's helps people who can't just envision, right? I think that's really big, but also they can see that they actually can build a house because they're probably thinking, well, where would I even put a house here? So you need to be thinking about not just for you, but for somebody else, right? Yes. Like how can they envision this? You already love it. You already bought this land. Of course you like it, right? But someone who's looking at it thinking, I want to put a house, or maybe someone's thinking, I'm going to buy a house. They can't find what they want. And they're like, well, I guess I'll buy land, but it seems too raw.
Yes.
This makes it feel like more doable, if you will.
Yeah. One of the big keys that I realized a while back, when you're trying to sell something to someone, always look at things through their eyes. Try to put yourself in their shoes. What are they seeing? What are their impressions going to be when they walk up? What are their biggest
roadblocks?
Yeah, what are their concerns? And you try to, you know, knock
mitigate
those off
them
the
off.
List.
Yeah. Yeah. So like not being able to get to the house. I mean, it's an easy thing to solve, but a lot of people be like, well, how would we even get to the house?
Right.
If you're talking to someone who's never built a house before, they're not even thinking of solutions because they don't know the problems. They don't know the solutions.
Perk tests are another thing that we do a lot with these rural properties, because if you can't get a successful perk test, you're not going to be able to build on these properties. So we're trying to take that concern off the table. Mm-hmm. So we find the good spot on the property to get the perk test done. We get that so we can present to the potential buyer so they're not concerned about that.
We want these to sell quickly.
Right.
And we have the people that we already know that can get out there and get things done. Right. So an end user might be like, okay, I'll get a perk test, but they might be like, well, I called someone and it's 6 months wait. So can we stay in escrow for 6 months?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So that's not going to work. Our goal is to move it quickly. And also if they need to get a loan, they normally need that.
Yeah. Oh, and property cleanup is another thing that's kind of in this category that we do quite a bit. The property cleanup is one of those things that, like, if there's lots of junk on the property, an old tear down mobile home or something like that, we'll sometimes get those taken care of in order to improve the appearance of the property.
I mean, we've had some crazy stuff, right? Tires, just stuff that you're kind of thinking, how can you envision living there? How can you envision a great family home or not a family home if there's junk everywhere?
Yeah.
Even though it's just because some random person decided to dump it there.
Yeah. Next one. We're getting close. I think we're at number 8. And that is assemblage.
I've never heard you use that word before.
Oh, okay. Well, assemblage is actually a really cool strategy that you can use in certain situations. It's not something that you can cookie cutter and do everywhere, but in certain situations, it really makes sense. So basically what you're doing is you're purchasing multiple properties to combine them for something of higher value.
I would have called it annexation.
Annexation is the next one, Heather.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even read that. That's hilarious, but I see how there's a difference. Oh my,
yes,
that's funny.
There's a difference.
Okay.
You could do this for purposes of maybe positioning it for a potential end user for a commercial property. You know, like you know that there's an end buyer looking for a huge warehouse facility and they need 25 acres and you're looking at the map and say, oh, I could buy this one from Joe and this one from Sally and this one from John and I could get them their 25 acres. And you know, that this end buyer may not even think to do something like that because they just see the smaller parcels and it's too much of a hassle. But if you're able to do something like that and buy the pieces for less than what you could resell the whole for, then you've created some value there. So it's called an assemblage. A lot of times it's used for residential subdivisions, commercial properties, and things like that.
I thought of another thing. So if you needed, like say you bought 20 acres, but you have to have each property there minimum is 25, but you also needed to have account for streets, you might want to assemblage.
No, yes, assemble. Create an assemblage.
Thank you. Create an assemblage to account for that.
Yes.
The extra buffer. Okay, that was, you stumped me.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
Stumped the heather.
Yeah, okay. And you were going to say that. That was fun. Okay, annexation. So I guess you could you're right, they are completely different, yes. Really, because you're annexation. Go ahead and explain.
Yeah, that. So annexation is when you go through the process to get a property added to a city. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're looking at, say, a city on the map, you know, land ideas, you can toggle a thing that says city limits. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some of these cities, they have these weirdest borders that are like jagged and like including some parcels, but not others that it looks like they should and all this stuff. So what happens basically is these cities grow over time, mm-hmm. and they grow by annexation. So they can't generally just take over certain areas. I mean, I'm sure that does happen in some scenarios, but in a lot of cases, established cities, they grow by the surrounding landowners that may share a border with the city saying, hey, I want to be part of the city because I want to get this zoned as a certain type of property.
Mm-hmm. I need you.
Yes.
You know, I need your services.
And you have utility, you have sewer, mm-hmm. you have water, you have all this stuff. So if you look at a property that's sharing a border with the city that's desirable, that may have something that you want, you may choose to do an annexation. And by doing this annexation process, generally the zoning gets set there. So you can say, hey, I want to annex into the city, but it's got to be this zoning and so on. And you go through the process. And generally these cities mostly are open to the annexation because they get more tax revenue. And as long as it makes sense, then they might do that.
Right. So normally some of these places will be just zoned county.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they don't really have a city designation already. They're right. Part of county land. And I always thought of the thought process that you did not want to be in a city because that meant more regulations and more cost. Mm-hmm. However, now having gone through all this, I realize there's a great benefit.
Right. Thinking as a developer, it makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. to do an annexation in many ways.
Right. So. But even as a homeowner, mm-hmm. a lot of times you can get better utilities that you couldn't have before. Like maybe you only had to be on septic, but you could get on sewer. You had to have propane piped in, but you could get on gas. Or right. City services a lot of times are actually more cost effective. We live in a city now. We used to live in a county, right. Us personally.
Right.
And a lot of like trash and stuff like that, this is a lot better pricing,
right?
Because you're now pooling with, it's normally higher density in a lot of ways, but you're pooling with other people, so the shared cost goes down,
right?
Water is cheaper, stuff like that. But yeah, as a developer, absolutely, because if you can get that change, and then you can also, a lot of times you can't build because if you're, you know, if there's limitations, well, the county doesn't have enough water, but the city could provide it coming from a different avenue because they've already worked out rates and they have openings. Sewer actually would be the
sewer. Yeah, that's a big concern.
Is the big issue. Yeah. So I don't know. That's really good. Thank you for your assemblage and your annexation.
Sure. There you go.
Different things because I've learned something. It doesn't happen often from you, but just kidding. That was it.
Heather knows it all.
I know I set you up for that, but that was great.
Are you looking for funding for your land flipping deal? Then head on over to partnerwithpete.com. It's an innovative new funding program where we split the profits with you 50-50, but we take it one step further and we handle every other step of the process in the land flipping business. Yes, that means we handle all the due diligence. If the property needs any value add, like clearing brush, perk test, survey, we'll get that paid for up front. Then when the property resells, we split the profits 50-50. There is absolutely no downside for you as an investor. If we lose money, we don't pass that on to you. But when we make money, when we make profit, we split the proceeds 50-50. So as a recap, we handle every part of the process. We split the profits with you 50-50. There's no downside for you as the investor, only upside. So go to partnerwithpete.com, submit your deal there, and we'll get it checked out within 24 hours.
Right. So is this my favorite time?
Well, yes. Just one little recap on this. Basically, these are just 9 different ways in order to do bigger land deals. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all kind of a tool in the toolbox. A lot of ways that I think you'll gain success in this business is if you specialize in one or two of these things and really go down those paths, really learn them, really hunt for properties that may suit whatever path you're looking for here and just duplicate it over and over again.
Right. So. And I was like, from the other financial side, like a lot of these, it's good to, you have a bunch of them going in different various stages so that you keep the cash flow going.
That's right. Yeah.
Because a lot of these are, I mean, not all of them, but some of them are like longer term stuff. And so you'd be surprised how quickly they start to hit once you get them going.
Yeah. You got to get that momentum building. Mm-hmm. And, but once you do, you have those properties in various stages of the, mm-hmm. the process and, they will start hitting.
You said the whole thing and how to think bigger. And I think the takeaway from that side would be, what is interesting to you here? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're like, I am a boat guy or, mm-hmm. and I, or an RV gal or
yes, person, you understand what that end buyer wants, you know?
Yeah. Or if you're just someone who's like, you know, a human that loves physical improvement to improve value.
Okay. Yes.
You know what I mean? I would go with what sounds interesting and then just go down that rabbit hole.
Yep.
Okay. You ready for some questions?
Let's do it. So this is the next segment of mm-hmm. the podcast where we take questions from our Land Conquest community, which again is found on the school platform, school.com/landconquest, or you can go to landconquest.com and there's a link to the community there. And we've got almost 5,000 people in our community now. So each week on the podcast, we cherry pick about 4 questions from the community and we answer them here.
Yeah, and 2 things. So school is S-K-O-O-L because yes. I would not remember that. And okay. I have not, Pete, this is kind of another stump to Heather because I don't read these beforehand. So okay. Michael says, business structure. I'm wondering how new investors are diving in. Are you making deals before you decide to set up an LLC? Are you using virtual addresses office to set up your entities? Or are you using your own name and home address to start? I value at least some privacy. I want to set up my LLC first with a virtual address. Just wondering how others are tackling their new venture. Thanks. So do not use your home address. You yes. can do the rest.
Yeah. So we always are using these virtual addresses for any business entities that, mm-hmm. that we set up and for all of our mailings and outreach and everything like that, your business address and your website, all that stuff. So we basically, it's a mailing service that we use and they collect mail for you. They scan it in so you don't actually physically get the mail unless you want them to physically forward it to you. But we'll set one of those up in a particular area and then we will get the entity set up. So I'm a big believer that if you are into doing something like this, you know, I guess you could do a deal in your personal name or whatever, but I really feel like if you're going to do it, you should do it right. Get an entity set up. It's not that much. There's services that will help you do it online for a pretty reasonable amount. So you got to get that set up. You got to get a business bank account set up, but do it for real. Like mm-hmm. if you want to do something for real, like if you want to make this a real thing, then do it the right way.
Okay, so. And I'll add my little thing. So we're not tax professionals. We're not legal professionals. We're just people who do this as a business.
We're just Pete and Heather.
Pete and Heather. So talk to your own professional for all those kinds of things. But I agree 100% that if you're going to do it right. There's a lot of reasons that you need to do that. We've been online for years and years blogging, all that kinds of stuff, and all sorts of people out there. So don't give out your home address. Yeah. Thankfully, knock on wood, haven't had any sort of thing like that. But you need to be careful. And a business entity is important for lots of different reasons. But even just the transactional side of things, you're going to be meeting new escrow and title companies, and you need to be presenting as professional.
Correct.
Do we have a company that we recommend that they could?
Yes. If you go to resources.landconquest.com, we've got a couple of the services that we've used on there before. They're very reasonable for like to get these entities set up. So mm-hmm. just we have special deals if you click through those links.
And also like for the other, like the mail stuff.
For the mail service too. We got a recommended mail services on that page too. So it's resources.landconquest.com.
Okay. Sounds good. So Jack says eBay deals. I just recently found out that people buy land off eBay. Doesn't sound very legit to me. Just curious if anyone's purchased land off eBay before.
I've never purchased land off of eBay before, but we purchased a home off of eBay.
Did we really?
Huh?
Was Remember? That like a long,
yes,
long time
a long,
ago
long time
in like
ago.
New York?
Yes, in New York, yes.
It's the worst house I ever bought.
I was just shocked because I was like, oh my gosh, Heather, you can buy a house there for like $20,000. Mm-hmm. We'll fix it up and we'll sell it. We didn't even have to be there. We'll just hire a contractor and everything. So I talked Heather into doing this and we broke even on it, I think.
We did. We broke
But it was
even.
Just like a year process.
Yeah, but the problem, it was just the contractor decided to like take off with
right
everything. So that was the problem. So I mean, but realistically, if we had kept that, it probably would be worth,
it would
you
be
know?
Worth way more.
Yeah. So I don't know. So yes, it's probably legit, but
I don't think there's nothing wrong with the platform.
No.
eBay is a legitimate platform. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of like, you got to make sure that the seller itself is legitimate.
Right. So and that the transaction.
I know land investors that kind of make it as a business model to buy the really cheap properties mm-hmm. and then resell them on eBay. But, you know, generally sourcing the deals on eBay. Maybe there are some deals to be had there. I haven't looked in a while.
There's deals everywhere.
So, yeah, there's deals everywhere. Yeah.
So, I mean, I would just do it. I would use the same skepticism and the same processes regardless of where you buy it.
Yeah, exactly.
So do with it what you may. I don't know if that sounds right. Okay, so Devin says, direct mail to Georgia resident changes. Disclosures are now mandatory when mailing Georgia residents. And then there's a Georgia penal code. Has anyone had luck mailing Georgia since these changes have gone into effect?
I wouldn't recommend mailing Georgia. They put a new rule in place, which basically it's disclosure when you are mailing people, you know, to buy their property. And, you know, there's all kinds of rules. It has to be something printed on the outside of the envelope, something printed on the letter and everything like that. And there's 49 other states that you can mail to. So I would take Georgia off the list personally if I were you. But that doesn't mean you can't still do business or prospect in Georgia. It's just kind of mailing to get the leads is probably off the table there. I would say, again, we're not legal advisors or anything like that, but I would say that it's probably better to avoid it. So,
You'd say you're avoiding it.
Mm-hmm. We're avoiding it.
Yeah. And I bet you there's a lot of other people avoiding it. So maybe there's an opportunity there, but you
not
have to
mail them.
No. Well, I mean, you'd have to understand that, right? You would need to talk to an attorney. That's the problem.
Yeah.
So you would be like, forget it.
Yeah, forget it. Yeah.
Okay. So Michael says, testing neutral letters. I'm going to test neutral letters for the next few campaigns. I usually send out 5,000 to 7,000 blind offer monthly. Should I send out the same amount of neutral letters or cut that number down? I'm a one man operation.
So neutral letters, basically the definition of that is basically it's a letter saying, hey, I want to buy your land. Give me a call. Let's work out a deal. It's a little bit more extensive than that, but that's the concept. And what we do is generally what they call blind offer letters, which is putting a value on that. Hey, we want to buy this property for this amount. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that with the neutral letter stuff, we've never done that, but this is just anecdotally from other investors that I know of that have used that.
Why haven't we done it?
Because you get a lot.
You're going to get to that, right?
You get a lot of people that are tire kickers that want top dollar. They want retail plus for their properties, 2-3 times retail in a lot of cases. It's kind of the same thing we ran in with cold calling. People are like, yeah, I'd sell my property. And then come to find out that they're, you know, they want 3 times what it's actually worth, you know? So it's, you get a lot of leads, I guess, but it's difficult to sort through those leads to actually get to the.
And is that, that's probably why his question was phrased as like, I'm a one man operation because he knows what's going to happen, right?
You could do what you want, but I think that if you're going to decrease the mail volume, you're also going to decrease the amount of actual deals you get at the end. So yes, you'll have more leads with a less mail volume, but how many of them actually make it to the finish line? And you're going to have to spend a lot of work in the meantime. So I don't know a lot of investors that are actually doing that strategy right now.
I think there's a lot of problems with that because putting some form of offer on that, it's getting rid of those people. Because there's a lot of people who say, well, everything's for sale.
Right.
Sure. You sent me a letter. You want my property? Sure. I'll sell.
And how bad do you want it?
Yeah. Exactly. And then they also, in that split second when they read that, they're thinking, I do want to sell it. And they already have a number. And then there's disappointment.
Yeah.
Whereas if they get a letter that has some sort of number there, they're not, you know, you get the ones who are just like, I'll sell for, you know, there's a price for everything. And then you get the people who are, you know, in their brain, they don't, their brain doesn't have a chance to go to that like $5 million. Yeah. So you wouldn't recommend it?
I personally wouldn't, but we've never done it. So I guess I could say that I've never tested it out. But
give it a try.
I know other investors that have that don't use it anymore.
So what would you say? I would say send out one. I mean, I don't understand this whole multiple times. I would try one.
You can always manage. Yeah, see how it goes.
Keep the same 5,000 to 7,000. You're one man show.
I think if you're really good on the phone, potentially this could be, and you're really good at following up, establishing rapport, and everything. Maybe you could really make something of that. And you're very refined with your list. And maybe if you are targeting properties that are value add type properties, maybe you're targeting properties where you could create all the value by just doing the lot split. You know, so you don't have to buy it as deep of a discount. You know, something like that. So there's ways that you could potentially make it work, but
I would also be on the phone like instantly.
Right.
Like I'd want to get right back to them.
Yeah, exactly.
So, because you don't want them to create more stuff in their brain. So, okay. Well, that was really fun. I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, great to have you back, Heather. Thank you everyone for listening or watching. Hopefully you're watching as well. We have this on YouTube. You can go find our channel. That's just type in Turning Profit and you will find our channel. Thanks, and we will see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Ready to start turning profit yourself? head to turningprofit.com to step up your real estate investing game. See you on the next episode.